What's up, UXers? I am very happy to introduce you to Jorge Arango, although he probably doesn't need an introduction. Jorge is an independent information architect consultant who helps companies gain clarity and confidence and traction. He's also a co-author on the fourth iteration of the Polar Bear book. And more recently, he's the author of a super cool little book, little compared to the Polar Bear book, called Living in Information, which was a total page turner for me. I highly recommend this book. And that book is what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be unpacking some of the concepts in the book that I personally was most interested in. Jorge is also the host of his own podcast, The Informed Life. And get this, I was recently a guest on his podcast, and that episode, episode 63, was just released on Sunday. So look at that. We are accidentally completely in sync. So after you listen to this conversation here on the OUX podcast, if you want to continue the Jorge and Sophia geek out, pop over to that episode. We'll put the link in the show notes. Okay, before we jump into the conversation, just a few OUX updates. So I have two updates, two little things that I want to talk to y'all about. So one thread on the OUX forum really got me thinking. That was from Jess Ryan of Cohort 4, and she was asking about group by as opposed to sorting and filtering on a list of objects. So Jess's project for the certification course was a redesign of an online platform she uses in her fiber arts hobby. This platform is called Ravelry, and it's a platform for knitters and crocheters to post projects and share patterns. So let's say Jess is looking at her list of patterns, so pattern being an object. She's looking at her list of all of her patterns. She might sort that list by like level of difficulty or time to complete. And she might filter by type of pattern, like just show me hat patterns or just show me scarf patterns. So remember, sorting is to reorder the list and filtering is to reduce that list down to, you know, a more manageable number. And nicely structured and nicely applied metadata is what allows users to do that, right? So sorts are usually best for metadata that is, for lack of a better word, graduated or gradiated, like price or popularity or duration, so that kind of thing. So while filters, on the other hand, are usually best for categories or types or statuses, metadata that doesn't necessarily have a high and a low value. So what about this group by? So in Jess's example, she wanted the ability to group by status of a pattern. For example, done, which might have a project object attached, work in progress, up next, and someday. So this is basically a sort for metadata that has that those non-graduated values. So group by creates a nice visual sections on the page based on that metadata. So this kind of visual chunking is something that I really haven't thought a lot about. I can see how useful it would be in so many scenarios to be able to say, let's sort by something like type or status or even category. If there's just a few of those potential values, I don't know if you'd want to group by anything that had more than like, I don't know, 7 or 10 potential values. So something like status makes a whole lot of sense where there's only about 5 values or maybe even just 3 values, you know, I'm done, work in progress, or up next. But I can really see the value for this. So I was just scratching my head and thinking about it, and I immediately realized we should be thinking about this, and probably during the part of the process when we're sketching out lists. So I went ahead and added that to the list sketch sheet. So if you use those card detail and list sketch sheets, I just updated the list one to just have a little note in there. So when you're thinking about the sorts, think about if any of those sorts, if you would want the ability for users to visualize a grouping of those as opposed to just kind of a linear sort. So it's a little bit of a nuance, but I can just see a whole lot of value in that. So I've linked in the show notes, we have a link to be able to download that that new those new CDL sketch sheets. And if you've never used the CDL sketch sheets, want to know more, go bother me on Twitter. If enough people bother me, maybe I'll do like an audio workshop on it. Maybe I'll go over to YouTube and do something to kind of walk you through how to use those sketch sheets. Okay, so one more thing. So Mike Vogel, another certified OUX strategist and also accessibility expert, has been helping us over here at Rewired to make OUX.com more accessible. And it has been so enlightening to learn from him. I hate to say this. I wrote a newsletter about this recently, how kind of behind the curve I am on accessibility, which doesn't make any sense at all because a lot of it is about semantics and making sure that the bits and pieces of your design are properly semantically tagged. So, which is what a lot about what OUX is about. So anyway, it's just driven a lot of interesting thinking about how an object map actually can help us think through accessibility strategies early on in the process while we are still talking about structure and semantics and not visuals, which is probably where that conversation should be happening. I have heard that from a lot of accessibility experts is the one thing that they really want, or they want a lot of things, obviously, out of our industry, which is not that great about accessibility. But one of the main things is getting accessibility in early and not thinking about it as kind of like Band-Aids that you add on later. So anyway, here's just one example of how I see an object map and OUX thinking kind of helping us bake in that kind of accessibility strategies early on. So one thing we were doing wrong on OUX.com is giving everything an alt tag. We were totally overdoing it. We were not intentionally thinking about images as decorative versus functional. So decorative images usually don't need alt tags. That can actually create a lot of audio clutter in a screen reader experience. And functional images kind of fall into two categories. Images that can be described at the object level and images that need to be described at an instance level. So let me give an example for what I mean by this. So for example, the icons for resource type that you see on the resource cards on OUX.com, they're totally decorative, right? They are, we can remove them. We don't need alt descriptions at all on those. Other images like profile pictures on a strategist detail page probably don't need to be specific to each instance. So no matter if you're on my profile or on Mike's profile or on Jess's profile, it can just say profile picture, all right? Because through being on that page, the user will probably already know which strategist they're on. So just having profile, just knowing that there's a profile picture and debatably that can be considered decorative as well. But what about images on an object like Orca Step, an object we will be adding in soon to help you explore the Orca process on OUX.com, which is going to be really cool. So if we have images on an object like Orca Step, those images will be descriptive diagrams, and thus each instance should have a specific descriptive alt text. So when we actually come across an image, like a core content attribute, as we're doing our object mapping, we can actually write then and there, pause, and decide, is this decorative? Okay, yes, yes, mark it as so. We don't need to worry about alt text. If it's functional, does it need to be described at the high level object level, or do we need specific alt descriptions for each and every instance? Okay. So we've got so many more exciting ideas on how the Orca process can help designers bake in accessibility really early on. And that's just one of the ideas. So we'll probably be coming out with an article soon. So if you're interested, please make sure you're on the newsletter at OUX.com/newsletter. Okay, let's go talk to Jorge about IA and ethics and environment versus place and UFOs. Yes, UFOs, and how extraterrestrial life might change our sense of place or our environment. It's going to be cool. All right, let's jump in. Welcome to the Object Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. Jorge Arango, welcome to the Object-Oriented UX podcast.
Thanks, Sophia. I'm very excited to be here.
All right. Yeah, I'm excited to have you. And we're going to be talking mostly about your amazing book, Living in Information. This was our last OUX book club pick. So we just had some really awesome conversations about it. And everybody in the book club absolutely loved the book, got a ton out of it, and just felt like it was so on the OUX wavelength. It really resonated with everything that we do over here in the object-oriented UX world. So what I want to talk about first is kind of your motivation to write this book. So what were you seeing in the digital design world that made you want to get these ideas out to the world? In other words, like what was making you mad or frustrated that you felt like people needed to read this book, or you needed to write this book so people could read it?
There's a confluence of things. The first thing that I'll say is that even though my name is on the cover, I consider the ideas in this book to be the articulation of a long-running conversation in the information architecture community as manifested in a conference that happens yearly, the Information Architecture Conference, previously called the IA Summit. And the issues that I delve into in the book are part of that conversation that's been happening for many years. But what happened that motivated me to write about it was essentially the political season of 2016. It felt like things had come to a head in that sensible civic discourse seemed to have become impossible somehow. And I'm not going to get into politics here. I'll just say that kind of from a neutral perspective, it became clear that the way that we were having very important civic discussions was not healthy.
It became really clear that we are living in information, and that the way that our information is structured and the way that information is delivered, the sources of our information, it became really clear that how much this can not only affect our day-to-day lives, but, you know, the future of the free world basically can be affected so much. Like how it became really clear to me how much and how important information is and how we structure information.
Well, we've been in a process of moving more and more of our everyday interactions, everyday activities to websites, apps, you know, places made of light. I think that's Terence McKenna's phrase. Places made nice. Places made of light instead of bricks and wood and so on. And the fact that we're doing so has implications for how those conversations happen. It's very different for you to have a conversation with a neighbor or perhaps even a stranger if you're sharing the same physical space than if you're doing so over something like Twitter or Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. And there's something about the nature of the place that influences the quality of the conversation. And there's something also behind the business model that makes the place viable that influences the tone of the conversation and the quality of the conversation. And the move from physical environments to what I call in the book information environments is not one that we can make without coming to grips with the changes that that entails to our ability to have these all important conversations, which is what living in a healthy, well-functioning society entails, right? Like if we can't talk with each other, we're not going to be able to make decisions about the way forward. And, you know, what are we going to do at that point?
So in your book, you talk about these greedy information environments and how we balance this with having that we need to be facilitating transparent engagement with each other. And I think this was in your chapter on engagement, where we sometimes get a little bit obsessed with engaging with the brand, engaging with our product. That's what a lot of our KPIs are around, is how people engage with our brand or our product. And that what we need to be focusing on is making sure that there's transparent engagement between each other, between people. How do we do that? It's like a huge question, but well, actually I'll ask a more pointed question. How can we recognize that the product that we're working on, that digital place that we're working on, and I'll get to in a minute, the difference between designing products and designing places. But because that's definitely a reoccurring theme in the book, but what are some signs that what the thing that we're working on and the design that we're doing, that we are facilitating one of those greedy information environments or greedy products?
Well, it might be worthwhile for folks who haven't read the book to take a step back and not define, but just clarify what we mean by greedy, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So the idea here is that the places that serve as our meeting places, let's say, are supported by some kind of business model, right? And if you meet with a friend at a coffee shop, which fortunately we're able to do more of now that that we're starting to come out of the pandemic imposed lockdowns. But if you meet with a friend in a coffee shop, the business model that is making it possible for that place to remain a going concern has to do with you consuming the products that they sell, right? Whether it's coffee or maybe a sandwich or what have you. And the coffee might be a bit more expensive than it would be if you like made it at home, for example, right? But the proceeds from those sales go towards enabling them to keep the lights on and the place clean and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And your relationship with that business is pretty clear in that you know what you're paying for. Many of the online places where we meet are supported by a business model that is not as clear as that of the coffee shop. They appear to us to be free in that we're not paying ourselves for use of the environment, because what they're selling is two things, right? And the cliche, if you're not paying for it, you're not the customer, you're the product. And that manifests in two ways. One is we're paying for it with our information, our data, right? Mm-hmm. Which gets resold in a variety of ways. But more to the point and to the argument in the book, a lot of these places are supported by business models that are based on advertising. And what advertising is persuasion. So some entity is paying let's call it the landlord, right? Like the person, the entity that owns the place, they're paying for access to our attention. Right, because they're trying to persuade us to buy something or to support some political candidate or what have you. And what I argue in the book is that it's very difficult to have a transparent conversation, one where you talk without intermediation with someone else, if the place where the conversation is happening is supported by basically trying to persuade you one way or another. Ultimately, you are, let's say, imagine that you're trying to have a conversation about politics in an environment where someone is paying to try to persuade you towards one political direction or another, right? Like I think that one could easily imagine how that would tilt the nature of the conversation. And I don't think that any of what I'm saying here is particularly new. A lot of this has been written about and much more competently by other people, which actually brings me to the third reason why I wrote the book. You asked me before, it's like, why did you write this thing? Mm-hmm. And the third reason has to do with an interaction that I had with a colleague shortly after moving to the Bay Area. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, which I think that rightly, for a lot of people around the world, kind of represents the epicenter of where the most influential information environments in the planet are being created and managed. And I moved here in great part to be close to the bright center of the universe and in that regard. And shortly after moving here, I was having a conversation with a colleague where I talked about information architecture, which is what I've been focused on for the majority of my career. And this colleague said that, to the essence, and I'm going to paraphrase, that information architecture was waning here. In the Bay Area, that it just wasn't seen as something that people paid a lot of attention to. And in my mind, there's kind of a Venn diagram between the idea that we're moving more and more of these key interactions to these online places. We had this kind of incredibly disruptive and chaotic political season in 2016, where these issues kind of came to a head. And the places, like the physical places where these key information environments are being developed, don't know about this discipline that is all about structuring these online places so that we can be more conscious and purposeful about what we're doing with them. And it felt like there was something needed to like bring those three forces into focus.
Right. So one of the things that I always teach to kind of like bring it to just to a takeaway for everybody listening, like one thing, and I just want to get your feedback on this, that I think is really important when it comes to advertising and when it comes to making it very clear that just the very simple thing of, this is content generated by other users, and this is content that's generated by brands. So the difference between whatever it is, if it's a pin on Pinterest, if it's a post on Instagram, if it's a story on Instagram, making it very clear to users that this is something from one of your friends, and this is something from a brand. So I think just differentiating those things, like I think that Pinterest doesn't do a great job. It just says promoted at the bottom. Tweets are often, it's not very clear whether what I'm looking at is a tweet or what I'm looking at is an ad, which is just two very different things. And they should be very much visually communicated that those are different. And then the second layer to that is if it is, let's say I've said, this is a pin from one of the people that I'm following, but why am I seeing it here? So that goes into the algorithms too. Why is this YouTube video being suggested next? Why is this pin being suggested next? So it gets into, what are these things? Is this an ad, or is this just some sort of innocuous post from a friend? And then if it's a post from a friend or if it's an ad, why are those things showing there?
Yeah, what you're speaking to there is context, right? The context in which you present information will change how you interpret it. And when you're showing a feed of content items, you can feed can consist of a variety of things, and it can consist of things that have been posted by your friends who you trust by almost by definition to a higher degree than you do a brand or somebody you don't know. And you can mix in, let's call them objects, right? Mm-hmm. That have been placed there by third parties or what have you. And the very nature of them being shown in the context of what your friends are saying should somehow elevate the trust. Even more so, if you can somehow get your friends to vouch for these things, they will the trustworthiness of the thing being sold will rise even more in your mind. So that's one level of it, right? Like this context in which the things being promoted are placed. There's another level that has to do with the fact that in an environment that is supported by advertising, the people who are stewards of the environment are incentivized to keep you around. You know, that's not true of the coffee shop. If you go meet with a friend at a coffee shop and you just have one cup of coffee, the people who run the coffee shop want you to either buy more coffee or somehow vacate the table, right? So that you make space for someone else to come and buy coffee. In these information environments that are supported by advertising, the folks who are running the place don't really want you to leave. They want you to see more ads because that's how they're making money. And that creates incentives that drive a particular selection of content for you to watch. And again, this is not original to me. Lots of people have written about this. In the book, I mention a very compelling framing by Zeynep Tufekci, who compared it to a meeting room that's been designed for meetings to keep going on forever, right? Like that would not be a very good meeting room, right?
No, nightmare scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet, you know, we're creating these places that that are designed for us to be engaged as long as possible, because the more we're engaged, the more money the place makes. And I must clarify, because I'm not a zealot about any of this. I think that advertising has a role to play, and there are online environments where advertising makes a lot of sense. Like, for example, if I'm looking for a product, you know, if I'm there to shop, I think that's an environment where advertising could actually be helpful to me. And I often make the comparison between an online place like Facebook versus something like Google. So Google, both of those are supported by advertising, but there's an important difference between them. When I search for something on Google, I'm looking for something. And when I find it, I go away. Right. And there are many times when I look for something on Google and the results include advertisements that are actually helpful to me, in that the starting point of the interaction is my issuing a search. So I've expressed some kind of intent to look for something, and the thing being shown somehow matches that intent. So I think that is a better use for advertising than something like Facebook, where I go to Facebook to engage with my friends, keep up with my family members, folks who I don't see very often in real life. And, you know, they might be posting about their kids' graduation or getting a new job or what have you. It's like, I'm not there to look for a product. I'm there to catch up with my friends, right? So it feels to me like some environments are a better fit for this model than others.
This gets to a little bit, and I do want to back up and talk about places and objects for a moment, but this kind of gets to that generative. You talk about generative information architecture, and when you were saying I go to Facebook to catch up with my friends, I think a lot of that's how it all started. But I think a lot of people go to Facebook to get the news now. And I don't know if that was an intentional on Facebook's part to say, okay, we're going to start becoming a news outlet. It just started happening where people were going to Facebook and Twitter to like see what's happening. And that became it. Somehow over the years became a news source where its original intention was not to be a news source. So how does that, I mean, how much should we, when we talk about generative and iterating on our information architecture and like letting that information architecture be something that's unfinished, and then through the use of people, it kind of, the purpose emerges from it. What is our job as designers to start saying, like, actually, this isn't what this should be used for. Like you talk about in the intro I think it's a Spider-Man quote about with great power comes great responsibility. And I think everybody that's listening, we can all agree that we have a whole lot of responsibility here. But what actually is our responsibility? Is it our responsibility to give people what they want? Or is it to kind of figure out what they need and then put some guardrails up? How do we balance that?
Yeah, there's a couple of things there, and I wanna circle back to a few of them. But I'll say that the first thing that comes to mind when it comes to responsibility is the idea that whatever it is that you're designing is not going to exist in a vacuum. Right? You're designing something that is being created by a team that, if it's a team within a large enough company, sits within a group, which sits within a company. And the company itself sits within a society, right? And there's this Saarinen quote about being aware of the context you're designing in and knowing that there's always a broader context that thing sits within.
Yes.
And the things that we're designing sit within contexts. And the contexts don't stop at the boundary of your group or your organization. We have to be mindful of the fact that society itself is a context that the organization depends on. You know, if we may have a thriving company, but if the society that it exists within somehow erodes to the point where it becomes dysfunctional, then the organization isn't going to be around very long. And again, there have been lots of books, especially in the last couple of years, on these subjects. The notion of the ethical responsibility that designers have towards society. The specific question that I tackle in the book is, how might designers help create places that foster a long-lived societies? I'm very concerned with ensuring that the societies that we live in stick around. You know, there are problems in our societies. All societies have issues. But in many ways, our societies are pretty good. You know, we just celebrated Memorial Day, and I've been reading a series of graphic novels about U.S. history with my son. And when you look at the ways that people have lived in the past, the struggles they've had to put up with, you know, being called to war, just having to live decent lives within appalling conditions. And you compare it to the relative peace and prosperity that we have today. I don't think that you can be a student of history, even a superficial one like myself, without coming to some degree of appreciation and care for what we have.
Right. And we've come a long way.
Yeah. And you know, when we are improving it, we're going to make it better. We're work to make it better. But we have to be careful to not inadvertently mess it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I have kids, like I said, and I want them to have lives that are at least as peaceful and prosperous as the one that I've enjoyed. So I think that ultimately, for those of us who are designing these things, where so much of the world is happening now, right? Like so many of our key decisions are happening in these information environments. We have a responsibility to ensure that we're not messing it up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I find that a lot of our thinking kind of stops at the company door, so to speak. Part of the book is also an invitation for us to think a bit more broadly about the things that we're making and putting out into the world.
It's so important about how, like, understanding what is in your locus of control and then understanding, taking it one step wider or even two or three steps wider, understanding this is where the stuff that is in my control is sitting within all this other stuff that's might not be in my control, but I need to be aware of, and I need to understand that larger context. How do we put boundaries?
This is a question, one of the biggest questions within the masterclass that I teach, within all the programs, the workshops that I teach. It always comes up, and I don't have a great answer for how do we define the edges on what we're designing when it comes to information architecture? How do we say, like, this is what is in my and kind of this gets into a question of breaking down silos as well. I mean, there's, of course, how does my company sit within the wider context of this industry and sit within the wider context of society? But we're still working, a lot of UX designers are still working with, how do I just get out of my silo within my company? Because we have teams that are there that are divided by page. Not joking. I mean, you know this, right? Or maybe sections in the journey map. So this team is all about browse, and this team is all about manage, and this team is all about buy, you know, and the objects and the environment, of course, the user is going through all of that. So the user doesn't experience these silos. So it's very difficult practically for information architects and UX designers to know how do I draw the boundaries? And then how do I even just break down to that one level of that one silo, right? So even getting the one level of larger context is often difficult. What advice would you give to folks that realize that and understand that they need to take that wider look, but don't necessarily know how to break down those silos?
Yeah, that's such a hard question. I teach a graduate systems studio at the California College of the Arts here in San Francisco. And this question of boundaries is one of the hardest questions that students tackle with. Mm-hmm. Because as it's so much in design, the answer often is it depends, which is such an unsatisfactory answer to anyone, right? And I must also say that to your specific image about like folks who are working in teams who are responsible for like a single page in the website. Mm-hmm. I think that it's easy for us to become dispirited if we feel like it's like us against the world, and we have this huge, you know, we're carrying the entire world on our shoulders. And then our responsibility is to, you know, just manage this one little piece. I do think that some folks are in positions that allow them to have greater agency than others. And it's very important for us as individuals to be clear on our own degree of agency, right? Like how much we can do within the scope of our job, or, you know, even if it's within our community, you know, and not be somehow delusional about that, right? Because that way lies disillusionment. If you somehow think it's like you're frustrated at the world, it's like, we got to change everything. And then you're responsible for this one button, right?
Yeah.
So I would say being aware of the issues is definitely something that everyone should take on, right? Like become an informed participant and try to do as good a job as possible, given the scope that you have responsibility for, while also looking up for the level immediately above you, right?
Right.
So if you're designing a page, you know, if you're tasked with designing a page within the broader system, then try to understand the context in which that page sits and ask how is this page serving that context, and maybe, you know, what role does that context play within the broader whole, and just take it from there, you know, but be aware that you might not have agency beyond that. And you work your way through it. And as you develop in your career, if you prove yourself competent and thoughtful and careful and a responsible agent within the system, you will be granted greater and greater responsibility, you know?
And I think asking those questions, like being asking more questions maybe than you feel comfortable asking, like always pushing yourself to ask those questions that might seem like questions that are beyond your pay grade, for lack of a better word, but like saying, okay, I'm going to ask these questions, and somebody might even question the fact that I'm asking the question. If you feel that level of discomfort that like somebody's going to say, why, you don't even need to know the answer to that question. If that is your reaction, I feel like that's even more of a reason to ask the question, to push yourself, to take that step further, and be kind of okay with being a thorn in the side of those silos, and always be, you know, push the boundaries, to use the cliche. One thing that I often also talk to folks about when it comes to breaking down those silos is recognizing like how, so an example I give is to kind of use an architecture metaphor is, if you think about an architect designing a bank, that architect needs to think about the back of the house experience as well as the customer experience, right? They need to think about the vault. They need to think about the how the money comes in. They need to be thinking about all those chutes and everything for the ATM or the drive up teller, as well as how people are going to queue up in line. And the architect needs to think about all these things, about all the roles that are going to come into that building, right? If an architect was to say, you know what, or the manager of the architect, the client of the architect was like, you know what, first, we're just going to think about the customers experience within this building. We're not going to think about the vault. We're not going to think about the back of the house experience. Let's just design the customer's experience first. That would be absolutely ridiculous from an architecture perspective, right? Like nobody would think that that would be a good idea if we're designing a building. But if we're designing a digital environment, this happens all the time. It's not only, no, don't just think about the customer experience. Just think about the queue, or just think about the entry vestibule. We're just going to redesign the dashboard, or we're just going to redesign the navigation, or we're just going to redesign the homepage, and don't think about anything else. So sometimes I tell people to actually use that metaphor to help people understand, like, okay, if we were designing something from a architecture perspective, that would just be, I mean, the building would fall down, right? If we weren't thinking about the whole thing holistically. So I guess my question on the heels of that, I mean, do you have any thoughts about that?
I have lots of thoughts about that.
Okay.
The move towards what we call user-centered design is one that I think happened as a reaction to what was perceived as an environment that was not giving users their fair due. And I think it was a healthy reaction in that regard. But I think it is possible to take it too far. And I think that a lot of designers take it too far. I've been in meetings where designers say things like, well, I'm here to fight for the users, as to mean that implicitly, it's like all of you stakeholders from other parts of the org are here to screw the user over. And I'm the sole, you know, I'm wearing this superhero cape here, and I'm going to be here to be the user advocate against these nefarious forces or whatever.
Right.
And I think that that attitude has been extremely harmful for design. It has placed us in a situation in which we are not seen, design isn't given its due in organizations, because a lot of designers are not seen as team players. They're seen as, you said thorn in the side earlier, right? Like, what do people do with thorns? They pluck them out, right?
yeah, that's right.
And if you want to be effectual as a designer, and you actually want to do good for the users, you have to understand that there are forces that are tugging the project in different directions. And the user's needs are one of those forces. And you could even argue that it's the most important force, but it's in no way the only force, right? And you need to balance that with the business goals of the team that is sponsoring the project. You have to balance it with regulations, right? If you're working in finance or healthcare or what have you, there's a bunch of regulations that are, they're going to be user unfriendly, right? Mm-hmm. And if you don't acknowledge these forces, you're going to either be very frustrated as a designer, or you're not going to last very long, right? Or alternatively, what's going to happen is what has happened in a lot of cases, which is that design has become seen as a production function rather than a strategic function. And by strategic here, I mean operating as an agent of coherent change so that you have a direction you want to move towards, and then you take concrete steps to do it, right? Design can be so much more than just crafting buttons and putting together design systems or whatever it is that folks are doing in organizations. Design is a way to make possibilities tangible, right? When you design something, you're putting down on paper or on the screen a different way of being. You're making it manifest in ways that can be tested and can generate feedback and start this wonderful loop whereby you create a good fit between the thing you're making and real world conditions. But if you limit yourself to thinking about just how this is going to serve user needs exclusively, right? Like without taking into consideration all of the other things that go into producing a design project, you're not going to be seen as someone who can collaborate at those higher levels. And I think it undervalues design and it undervalues designers.
Right. And this gets back to that difficult conversation on the boundary, like the what am I designing question, where, okay, you might be tasked with designing X, but then you need to think about, well, what is the authoring system of X look like? So there's all this content that content creators have to create. What is their experience as a content creation? And then you have to think, of course, about the business as well. And there might be an administrator role. So thinking about all of these roles coming into an environment. And I think this kind of gets to the question that I have about places versus objects or, systems of systems, where we tend to think about, okay, we draw a line and we say, here's not only just this side of the environment versus this side of the environment. We think about them as completely different products. We think about there's the product for the customer service, and then there's the product for the customer, versus these two roles are going into an environment and they might see different things in that environment. They might see those things from different angles, and they might even be able to do different things to those things. But they don't necessarily need to be completely separate environments. Or do you think about them as separate environments? If you think about the roles, there's the environment for this role, and then there's the environment for that role. Or do you, when you're designing, do you think about, like, I'm designing this one environment, and different roles come into that environment and potentially have different powers or views of that environment?
We move through different environments and we kind of wear different hats in each one of them, right? So I'm speaking to you from my home office, which is a tiny little converted closet that I've set up for this purpose, right? And I have a particular mindset when I'm in this space. I have a role, to use your language, right? And when I step out of this room in a little bit, I will be with my family, and I will take on a different role, right? And the role is influenced not just by the physical place, but also by the other folks who are there, right? Like I'm in this environment now, which I would argue that the most important aspect of the environment that I'm in right now and the role that I'm playing isn't even present physically in this space, which is namely you, right? Like you, I'm having a conversation with you that is kind of dictating the role that I'm playing here. And we shift those roles as we move from one environment to another and interact with different people. And I think we do the same thing online or in apps, like when we're interacting in these information environments. And I'll give you an example. You talked earlier about banks, right? So if you visit a bank's website, most bank websites have at least two very different environments. They have the quote-unquote marketing environment, where the bank is explaining all their wares to you. They're telling you what products they have and what you can do with them and how they compare to other banks and all that sort of stuff. And then they have a more private part of the environment, a more private place, which if you're a customer of the bank, you can access by entering your username and password into a couple of fields. And in many cases, in fact, most of the ones I've interacted with, they're fairly different. You know, they have different navigation structures. They have different affordances. They sometimes look very different, right? And your mindset shifts when you go from one to the other. You're playing different roles. When you log in, you are there to accomplish a task. You're there to, pay your credit cards or transfer funds or what have you. And those are very different roles. And we tend to think about these things in terms other than environments. We tend to think of them as products or interactions. And I understand why that is, because there are good commercial reasons to think of them in that way. But environments are different than products and different than objects, by the way. You talked about the difference between objects and environments. I think that a house in some ways is an object. It's just a very big one, right? Mm-hmm. Is that there's this ontological thing where you can think of anything that you can interact with as some kind of object.
Well, like Andrew Hinton says, it depends on the perspective, right? Yes. The building is a thing if you're walking down the street, and then becomes a place once you go inside.
Yes, it depends on the perspective. It also depends on scale, right? When I think of an object, I'll pick one up from my desk here, and obviously your listeners can't see this, but I'm holding a pencil sharpener. Right? This is an object that I can manipulate. I don't think of my house as something that I can manipulate. I think of my house as something that I inhabit. And moreover, I don't inhabit the entire house. I inhabit one room at a time. So I spoke of my office, right? I'm sitting in my office and I am in Zoom somehow right now with you. And one of the tricky things about these online things that we've been designing, these digital things, is that scale isn't as clear to us as it is in the physical world. Mm. There's an information architect called Sarah Barrett who's been writing wonderfully about this in Medium.
She was on the podcast.
Oh, fantastic. I didn't realize that. So yeah.
Yeah.
Sarah's great. And she's been writing very compellingly about scale, right? And how different scales affect our understanding of what we're dealing with. And one of the things about digital is that it's harder for us to grok scale than it is in the real world. And again, the listeners can't see me doing the air quotes thing, right?
Yeah.
But that also kind of frees us up to take on different perspectives, different frames, right? And we've been framing these things as other products. But for some of them, at least, we can adopt the frame that they are places. And if you do that, you might start thinking differently, not just about how you design for them, but, and this is a critical word for me, how you steward them. Mm-hmm. Because we are, places are not something that we design and quote unquote release, right? Or not just design and release. Places are things that you maintain, that stick around, right? And I spoke earlier of wanting our societies to stand the test of time. Well, I think that we have to start adopting more long-term thinking in the things that we make. We're not just designing this for the next quarter.
Yeah.
We're designing something that, if it's successful, is going to serve potentially as the foundation for, like we said earlier, things like our civic discussions. And they should be good, right? Like good with a capital G. They should not just be a source of something that we check our OKRs off in this quarter or whatever, right? It's something that we should design with the mindset that it's going to serve our needs in a longer time frame.
So pause real quick. How much more time do I have with you? Because do you have a hard stop in 4 minutes?
I don't have a hard stop in 4 minutes.
So I can take another 10 minutes from you?
Yeah.
Because there's something I definitely want to get to. And
let's do it.
But then I also want to have the last question, which I want to talk about UFOs. So I know there's supposed to be a big announcement today that might really change our information environment of just like how we think about the world. Okay. So I feel like that, I mean, I kept alluding to this, talking about the difference between places and objects, and definitely a reoccurring theme in the book is how, like you were just saying, how we need to stop thinking so much about designing digital products or tools, which can be much more ephemeral, and thinking about designing these digital places that that have more of that staying power, that are more these like long-term design projects that can really, that, you know, have are good with a capital G. And I just want to just get this out there, because this might, on the surface, might seem at odds with something called object-oriented UX. But for anyone that is listening, I want to clear up that OUX is 100% about designing digital environments, because it's about figuring out what are those things that make up these environments and how do they relate to each other within the context of that given problem domain. So we could even call it place-oriented UX or environment-oriented UX. But just a quick question. So because words are important, I often use place and environment interchangeably. Good with that? Place and environment, basically the same thing. And then also, and then there's another one. Also, I use it interchangeably with system. So do you differentiate between place and environment, and even place and environment versus a system?
Yes. I'll say that yes, asterisk. And the asterisk is, this might get kind of pedantic pretty quickly, right? I think that for everyday usage, if you want to... if you're going to be using it just in everyday conversation, I don't think that the distinctions are that important. But in my mind, at least, places are types of environments, and what makes them different is habitation, right? If you think about the word environment, we use the word environment not just for our surroundings, but also for things like the environment that we're polluting, right? Like the entire biosphere, you know, that's a pretty broad construct, right? Whereas places I think of as special parts of the environment that we somehow imbue with meaning through our interactions, right? So my office here is an environment, but it's also a place. And again, I think that might be like a little pedantic, but it's a subtle distinction.
But you could have an environment. Well, then we get into like type of environment. Like, am I in an urban environment? An urban environment is a type of environment, but then there's like Chicago.
Yeah.
And then there's, a park in Chicago. There's Millennium Park in Chicago, which feels much more like there's a sense of place there.
Yeah. And we also use the word in a more abstract sense, right? Like we can talk about the media environment. And and the media environment is not something that you can inhabit in the same way that you can inhabit Chicago, but we do have this sense of environment as a sort of a context that that creates conditions that influence our behavior somehow. At least that's how I see it. I know that there are lots of very technical definitions for these terms. But you also asked about systems. And I think that systems are something else. Because I think that all of them are interrelated, right? I think that environments are systems, but not all systems are environments.
Mm-hmm.
And a system, I would say, is an even higher level of abstraction, where when I think of systems, I think of collections or sets of elements that somehow work together towards a broader purpose, whether intentionally or not, right? Like we perceive it to somehow work together towards some kind of purpose. And we speak of the solar system, right? Like the solar system is a system, but I don't know that you can call it an environment in the sense that we've been talking about, right?
Mm. Oh, that gets to my UFO question.
Such a great segue, right?
Such a great segue, but I'm not ready for it yet.
Oh, no.
I'm not ready for it. But so when it comes to designing places. So the process that I teach hits on these four main pillars, which is objects, relationships. So we got things, we got them in context. And then also calls to action, which you can think of like as just explicit affordances. And then attributes.
Hey y'all, just a quick interruption. As of this recording, we are in the midst of cohort 4 of the OUX certification, and enrollment for cohort 5 won't open up until early summer 2021. But you can dig into all the certification video content, all the templates, all the resources by grabbing access to the OUX Masterclass. And if, after going through the masterclass, you want to get certified, you'll be able to apply the cost of the masterclass to your enrollment in cohort 5. So you can kind of think about it like a down payment. Once you enroll in the masterclass, you'll get access to the OUX Academy. And over the course of 10 weeks, about 2 to 3 hours of video lectures will be released to you each week. But you can consume that content totally at your own pace. You'll have lifetime access to it. So if it takes you 20 weeks to go through it, that's totally fine. You're not just gonna get video content. You're gonna get checklists. You're gonna get exercises. You're gonna get assignments and tons of valuable resources. Basically everything you need to become an expert complexity wrangler. Again, you get everything that a certification cohort gets, just minus all those personal touches. the camaraderie of the cohort in the OUX forum, access to the OUX mentors, the one-on-ones with me, as well as me answering all your questions in the forum and in office hours, and of course, the actual certification and a profile on OUX.com. So for all of that, you'll need to actually join a cohort. But you don't have to wait. You can start becoming that complexity wrangling, stakeholder whispering, IA facilitator extraordinaire now. You can start saving yourself and your team countless hours of rework. And you can start saving your user from the extraneous complexity that OUX helps you avoid. So go to OUX.com/certification to learn more. From there, you can get on the waitlist for cohort 5, as well as get yourself access to that entire video library that is the OUX Masterclass. Still not sure if you're ready to take the plunge? Go check out the testimonials on OUX.com. Okay, back to the show. So, and in your book, you talk about, I think in your words, that would be elements, relationships, affordances, and signifiers. So we're talking kind of about the same things, using slightly different words here. But like, I feel like there's something missing, like, because we talk about, we need to sort of define how all these things come together. And then the sum is bigger than all of those parts. So if those are the parts and you have the sum of those parts, if I'm designing a place, if I'm designing a digital place, what else do I need to be thinking about other than what are the things that make up this place? How do they relate? What do people need to do to those things? And what is the information that people want about those things?
Sure. I'll address that. I'll just say that I do understand the four elements that you're describing. I do think that affordances and signifiers are slightly different than CTAs and attributes. And again, I don't want to derail us by going in that direction. But yes, to your broader point, there is the two sets of ideas are highly complementary. Right. The way that I understand object-oriented UX, what it's doing is it's kind of formalizing and manifesting an ontology that defines a conceptual domain somehow that is coherent in some way. Right. And that's also what we're after when we're creating an information architecture. I think that what I would say in answer to your question about what we need to keep in mind when doing these things is that we can focus on the individual elements that that comprise the system, right? And we can optimize them and even think about the relationships between them as being meaningful. But it's very important that we also conceive of the set as a thing that has an impact on how people perceive the place, right?
Right.
So if you walk into a bank, there's no one single thing that tells your mind that you're in a bank, even if that thing is like a sign that says bank, right?
Right.
There's a whole constellation of other elements that need to be present for you to understand the place as a bank, right? And you can conceive of all of those things as individual objects that have relationships to each other. But what creates the sense of bankness in your mind is the set. It's not the individual parts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that designers, particularly designers who do the type of work that we're describing here, one of the abilities that we bring to bear to the work and that we need to hone actually is the ability to shift our focus between working on the elements that comprise the system and then zooming out to see the effect of the set. What is the whole conveying, right?
Yeah.
When you create I have this exercise that I do with folks, with students and with folks to whom I present these ideas, where I show screenshots of websites that where I've blocked out all the branding, and just have them guess at what the place is by just looking at elements in the navigation bar and labeling throughout a page, right? And it's if you try this for yourself, which is hard to do if you pick the site yourself, right? But if you have someone else pick a site for you and block out the branding, I think you will find that you can very quickly surmise what the place is about just from the things that you read on the screen, right? So the whole is creating a context. It's not just the individual elements that matter. It's how it's the set of elements and how they relate to each other. So I would say that's something to emphasize here as we're talking both about information architecture and object-oriented UX.
And that, I think the example you gave in the book was the navigation had poses, classes, poses, schedule, lessons, and studio, I think were the things in the nav. So everybody that's listening, what might that be? Is that right? I think that those are close enough.
Yeah, right? I haven't seen the example in a while, but yeah, I wanted to pick one for the book that was not as easy to guess at as the bank one, right? Because in the bank one, you see loans and credit cards and so on, and you quickly figure it out.
But that's what it is. So what I'm trying to get at, though, is with the obviously that's a yoga studio, right? We've got poses and but those are all the things. Those are all the meaningful things. Even with a bank, you've got credit cards, you've got loans, you've got accounts. So when you have the navigation, I usually recommend the navigation is usually going to go to the list of the main things: credit cards, accounts, loans. I'm starting to learn what are the things in this place, and I can take that bottom-up approach and say, okay, here's the things in this place. Now I can extrapolate what the place is. But then when we think about that sum, we think about the purpose of that place, right? You talk about behaviors and outcomes. Like, what do we want? So with the bank, it might be financial health, right? Might be the overall purpose or outcome that we want for the people that are in this place. How do we, and this is another like big can of worms question, but how do we kind of balance that bottom up approach of saying, okay, I know that these are going to be the important things in this place, and this is how they connect. This is sort of the truth of the system that I'm going to be pretty agnostic about, versus a top down approach of like, here's what we want. Here's the kind of sum of the parts. We want financial health. Now let's figure out what things can lead to that financial health versus here's the things that just belong in this environment and the outcome is sort of out of our hands.
Yeah, that is the trick. You've put your finger on it. The I think that the single greatest challenge for people doing this type of work is coming to grips with the balance. I'll call it the tension between top down and bottom up. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Top down, you do what you're describing here. And I was speaking earlier about strategy, right? Like you're trying to somehow enable, you called it financial health. Financial health is a fairly abstract goal, right? A more concrete goal would be something like the person wants to pay their credit cards on time, right? Which contribute to financial health. Right. So if you're having a discussion about financial health, the obvious next step is to unpack that and make it more granular. It's like, what is financial health, right? What are we talking about when we talk about financial health?
Yep.
And that's going to lead you to conversations like, well, you spend less than you make. I don't know. Maybe that contributes to being financially healthy, right? And then you can have conversations about, well, what systems allow people to manage their spending, right? Mm-hmm. What analogs can we experience? And by the way, this is something else where designers have been, digital designers, I'll say, have been somewhat myopic in that none of us come to these experiences as blank slates. Even if it's the first time that you visit a bank's website, you come to that experience with a mental model about what banks are and what they're for, right? Like, what you have expectations that you bring to this interaction. And that's why we do research. We need to understand what those mental models are. And on the other side, we need to understand the conceptual domain. You know, what concepts do you need to make available to people for them to be financially healthy? And design is somehow about bridging the gap between those two, right? Like, people come with these imperfect mental models by definition to deal with this domain that is often pretty complex. So we have to get versed on the complexities of the domain and the mental models that people bring to them, and then find ways of creating bridges that that make people's lives better.
Okay, I have one more question for you. All right, so we're gonna back up to your really great segue that you gave me a few minutes ago, talking about how we think about the solar system as not really an environment, right? We don't think about, because we're not thinking about that kind of that level of larger context. Now, in the COVID relief bill, there was a small line item that the Pentagon had to release a statement, I think a document on June 1st, which is today, as of this recording. We are at June 1st. And I have not checked today. I didn't want to check if they had released the document yet, because I knew that I would be completely distracted during this conversation. So I don't know what they've released. They might not have even released it yet. But basically, the Pentagon needed to release what they know about unidentified flying objects, right? There's been a lot in the news. Like, I think they were trying to release stuff just under the radar of COVID, but we had all these, the Pentagon basically saying, like, here's some leaked recordings. We don't know what these things are. It could be China, it could be Russia, it could be us, and we don't even know. It's too deep for us to even know, or it could be something else. Let's hypothesize that this, let's do a thought experiment, that this statement that comes out says, we are working theory right now is that these things, we don't know what they are, but we think that they are extraterrestrial. Okay, now all of a sudden, so many mental models are gonna burst, right? If that was the statement, because I think what's happening here is the Earth, we think of the Earth very much as a place. We are in it. And there's like the International Space Station, and there's the moon that maybe we have a robot on. We've got a robot on Mars somewhere, but really we just think about we're in it. But how, if we all of a sudden knew as a species, we knew that there were other intelligent species for a fact. This is, so my question is, one, do you have any thoughts on this, on like how that might change, like how we perceive the Earth as potentially a place versus an object? Because now it's like, oh, we are this thing in a wider system of things. But then, I mean, the more practical question that comes off of the tails of this is, how do we mitigate big structural change that might happen within our organization? We realize that there's a big piece missing, and we need to have a massive change of the information architecture that can really break somebody's pre-existing model of how the world works. So I'm just gonna throw that out there and let you run with all of that.
Wow, that's a question of galactic proportions.
It is. Well, did you know about this? Did you know about the thing that was happening?
Well, I've been following the news. I didn't know about the drop, but I've been following the news, and there's all these videos that have been released and stuff. Default disclaimer for this conversation is that I'm gonna channel Carl Sagan and say that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, right?
Right.
But I do agree with you that the discovery of, or the discovery of extraterrestrial life would precipitate wide-scale reframings, right? We would suddenly shift our understanding of our place in the universe. Not for the first time, right? Like, it would be the first time with intelligent life, but people have had to shed misconceptions about their place in the universe many times before, right?
And right. Galileo tried to do that with mixed results.
Well, yeah, I mean, people resist, you know, it's not, change is hard. Change is hard, and we need to acknowledge that. And this goes back to your question about the organization, right? There is such a thing as social inertia in that we, and I was talking earlier about how we have it pretty good in the big picture, you know, we have it pretty good now. And now you're going to tell us that this thing, what are you doing to us? Right. So there's always a temptation to resist change, especially when the changes are so, you know, can rock the foundation, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be surprised if such an announcement were met with both skepticism and resistance, at least by some parts of society, in much the same way that major initiatives are met with resistance in organizations, major change initiatives, at least in some parts of the organization, right? I think that leadership has a huge role to play in helping the society or the organization or whatever navigate changes successfully. If you have leadership that is clear, has clear values, that is trusted, that clearly explains the implications and clearly explains what we don't know, right? And also has the authority and the credibility to make the hard decisions that are necessary to navigate such changes, then I think that the transition can happen with less pain, let's say, or less struggle than if it happens more chaotically. Again, top down, bottom up, right?
Right. And you were sort of talking about this on your podcast. I think it was with Jesse James Garrett about information architecture and what does information architecture leadership look like? And how do we get, you know, how do we get information architecture into the leadership discussion? So I would recommend that episode of Jorge's podcast for everybody listening. All episodes of the podcast for sure. Thank you so much for spending so much time talking to me about all this really interesting stuff. I got through about 30% of my questions. So I'll definitely be bothering you maybe for a follow-up in 6 months or something like that. But I really appreciate your time, the work that you put into the book. I recommend that book to everybody. So Living in Information, everybody should go grab a copy. Also, Jorge, you've got your podcast, The Informed Life. You're on Twitter. We'll link to your Twitter. Where else should people go to find you or find what you've got going on?
Well, my primary place online is my website, which is at jarango.com. That's jarango.com. And from there, you can find all this stuff, links to the book, the podcast. I have a newsletter. So yeah, folks can follow up with me there.
Wonderful. Thanks again, Jorge.
Thank you, Sophia.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!